Yeah, so maybe what I have in mind is simply the potential for us to rely on the reconstruction of the history of the different Buddhist tradition as it has been done in the academic tradition, in the academic study of Buddhism. Because being myself an academic, I'm of course familiar with that. And what I'm thinking of is to take, I mean, academics on, there are some points where academics are not in agreement and where the discussion is continuing, but there's a certain kind of progression of ideas and thoughts and developments where pretty much all academics would agree on. And so for us, shifting from my academic side to the practitioner side, for us as practitioners to use this informed understanding of the development of the different Buddhist tradition as a framework in order to hold the different Buddhist tradition that come from different traditional backgrounds.
Right.
And this I see as a unique opportunity because in so far in the history of Buddhism, this vision of all of the traditions as they develop one after the other has not been there. And so we have teachers from a particular cultural background who present what they have to give as what they perceive as the true teaching of the Buddha. But then we have somebody else from quite a different cultural background and they do the same thing. And they perceive their form of teachings, their doctrines, they do not perceive it on this historical continuum, but they see it as the direct relationship to the Buddha. And so we as Westerners now are faced with these different positions, which of course don't agree with each other. There is some conflict. And so the question is now, how do we handle that? And there's one way of opting for one of these traditions and saying, okay, this is the right one, and then automatically like excluding all the others, they're wrong. So I follow my teacher says such and such, this is right, everything else is wrong. And I see that as a great impoverishment. And the image I like to use is as if the different Buddhist tradition are like different colorful flowers.
Mm.
And this three-dimensional image of all these different flowers becomes two-dimensional and black and white.
Mm.
This is right and wrong. Finish. And this is the other extreme, is to indiscriminately mix it all together into one thing, as if I were taking all these different colors and put them into a blender. You would just get gray. The colors is also lost.
Mm-hmm.
So my suggestion is, can we allow each of these colors to be and just let them sit side by side? And the way to do that, according to my understanding, is by simply seeing that for a particular period in the history of Buddhism, this is the idea they were operating on. This is the conception of the Buddha they had. This is the type of practice they were doing. And within that framework, this is eminently meaningful. But moving on to another period of Buddhist history, different doctrines, different practice, different conception of the Buddha. Again, within this context, entirely meaningful. I can hold these two, or more than two, side by side without having to decide right or wrong by simply having this groundwork of the history of Buddhism,
right,
of knowing this is early Buddhism, this is 500 years later, this is 1,500 years later. And that conflict is no longer there. And you one more story or?
Please.
Well, I just recently had this experience with a nun from Burma, and so she was practicing in the Goenka tradition, and she was studying under her Abhidharma teacher. And out of these two, she had a conflict about something which is called the Hadaya Vattu, the heart element. And so she wrote to me, and it was a real conflict for her. Like the Abhidharma tradition says the Hadaya Vattu is the heart. In the Goenka tradition, the Hadaya Vattu is the solar plexus. So the question she and other in the tradition, like, who's right? Who's wrong? What? How do I work with this? And so I use that as a trial out for this kind of methodology I'm proposing. So what comes out of that then is, that first of all, from a historical perspective, Hārayavatthu was not taught in early Buddhism. So it arose only at a considerably later time in the Theravada tradition. So this takes away a little bit of this urge of, like, if I don't know exactly what the Hārayavatthu is, how am I going to get awakened? Everything depends on this. It kind of just, it's a concept that arose at a particular time, but there have been practitioners who have not been using this concept, and they were able to progress to awakening, and the Buddha himself. But then we don't become fundamentalists and say it's both wrong because it's not taught by the Buddha. That would be the other extreme. No. The Hārayavatthu is a very meaningful concept in the Abhidhamma commentary. Actually, it's not even in the canonical Abhidhamma, it's in the commentary tradition. And we can even support it with modern research, because we know that people who have had a heart transplant, it's a very interesting thing that they find that they experience emotions that are associated with the person who has been the donor of the heart. So there seems to be some sort of emotional memory, I don't really know how to call it properly, but there is something that really comes over with the physical heart. And so it is an eminently meaningful teaching of the Abhidhamma commentaries to speak of the Hārayavatthu as the physical heart. Now we move to Goenkaji. Goenkaji's the approach that he teaches, based on what he learned from his teacher Ubakin, is very much this working with what he calls vibrations. And this has a lot to do with the energy body. And so for the energy body, the solar plexus is indeed a very central point, and is precisely where you can experience, in this particular Vipassana tradition, the intersection between body and mind. So if you look at it from the framework of this tradition, it is eminently meaningful to speak of the Hārayavatthu as the solar plexus. And it was very beautiful to see that for this Burmese nun and her friends, the whole situation, the whole tension dissolved. They were suddenly able to see that there is no absolute correct thing about the Hārayavatthu, but there are contexts in which I can meaningfully use this concept, and I can use it in different contexts without there needing to be a conflict. I don't have to decide which interpretation of Hārayavatthu is the correct one. There's one context, this one is correct. There's another one, this one is correct.
I so appreciate that, because there can be times in my own practice and practice without speaking with others where we have an experience and we are looking for a map, a conceptual map, some other kind of mirror to our experience. And so when we don't find it, maybe in the particular tradition that we're practicing in, there can be this this wish to have some deeper understanding. Yeah. But without having the context with which we're entering into a different map or a different system, that reflection can be almost more confusing.
Exactly.
And so what I hear you saying is how important it is to really appreciate the whole context with which a particular offering is being being shown.
Exactly.
Yeah. And really that it's all about bringing it back to skillful means.
Yeah.
That the underlying motivation is skillful means.
Yeah.
And there's still a respect for plurality within that, within this approach.
This is the important part, the respect for the plurality.
Yeah.
That's like we can recognize that there are different Buddhas. Mm. So for us, with our Western background in scientific inquiry, the really interesting thing is the historical Buddha. The Buddha as we can reconstruct it, which is much of my work, this early Buddhism comparative study. What is the most probable understanding of what the historical Buddha actually taught? Mm-hmm. But again, in order to avoid this leading into a kind of fundamentalism, we have to understand that other Buddhist traditions operate with different Buddhas. You see, if I get a teacher, let us go again to Burma. So the Burmese teachers of this nun who teach Abhidhamma, their Buddha is a Buddha who taught Abhidhamma. And it is totally meaningless to go to one of these venerable sayadaws and tell them, no, the Buddha didn't teach Abhidhamma. They just they don't even understand what you're talking about. Because for them, their Buddha, and after all Buddhas are just mental constructs that we make. Their Buddha is the Buddha who taught Abhidhamma. He went to the heaven of the 33 to visit his mother, and that is when he taught the Abhidhamma. And then we maybe have this Tibetan Rinpoche, and his Buddha is one who started to teach, first of all, the Buddha Vatamsaka Sutta. And when this Buddha found that people could not understand Buddha Vatamsaka, only then he taught Hinayana. Again, if we come from this historical thing and we hold it too strongly, there will be conflict. But what I suggest is to simply recognize these as different constructs of what the Buddha is. And I have perfectly entitled to have my historical Buddha. But I can hold that in such a way that I don't create a conflict with these other Buddhas. And there's again a little story I like to tell. This is about when I was living in Sri Lanka. I had a meditation center there. And besides running the meditation center, we were also doing some social work. There's a lot of poor people in Sri Lanka, so we were doing all these various projects to help people. And there was also one woman, and she had a lot of children, and the husband had either run away or passed away, and she was in a desperate situation to just feed the children. And she was had some ability at wood carving. So we got the funds, we bought her the tools, and we bought also, she needed some special wood, and so she started this wood carving, and she could support her children. And in an expression of gratitude, she came to the center, and she brought me a Buddha statue. And it was a beautiful wooden Buddha statue she had made, but it had this protuberance on the head. And yeah, maybe I should first talk a little bit about the protuberance, and then I come back to my story. So this protuberance is a development that we know from the history of Indian art. In the early suttas, it is very clear that the Buddha had a physical appearance that did not make him easily distinguishable from other people. And one of the 32 marks of the Buddha's beauty is the Unhisa Sisa. He had a head that was rounded like a turban. But when in ancient Indian art, the beginning of representing the Buddha in sculpture or painting, there was a tendency of presenting saints with hair, and usually in a topknot. So the Buddha, and they also did this for the giants, where we know the giants, they actually pluck out their hair. It's impossible for their hair to grow. They were still being depicted with long hair and usually like put together and put in a top knot. And this feature in artistic representation of the Buddha then was re-understood in later tradition to mean that the Buddha actually had a protuberance, that there was some sort of fleshy or even bony outgrowth. And if you look at Buddha statues nowadays, in all different Buddhist traditions, you find this something coming out there. And so with my historical understanding, and now we move back to my situation in Sri Lanka, I didn't like the protuberance. So I asked this woman, I appreciate the Buddha statue very nice, but can you take off the protuberance? And she said, yeah, no problem, come on, and she took out her tool, and so she started to take off the protuberance. And I was all the time just watching what she was doing. But this meditation center, I was the only white one, the others were all Sri Lankans, so there was the whole room was full with Sri Lankans. And she just chipped off the protuberance, and as she was doing it, to me, it became more and more and more of a Buddha. And I was very happy about it. And when she was finished, I looked up, and I saw all the other Sri Lankans. They looked so sad. They all made long faces, and one of them said, Bhante, this is no longer Buddha. And you see the point. The thing is, for them, this is an absolutely essential part of a Buddha. And by taking it off, I had turned this beautiful Buddha statue into just a Buddhist monk. It was no longer Buddha for them. Now, can I claim that I'm right? And they were wrong? No. I mean, they were in the majority. If we are democratic, I was wrong. Now, I think I have the right, if it is a Buddha statue for myself, to take off the protuberance. Nobody can dispute that. But I don't think I have a right to say that this is the only way a Buddha should be, and that the Buddha with his knuckle, because I know this is just a device from Indian art and it has no meaning. You see the point I'm making?
Yeah.
Just holding and allowing these different visual representations of the Buddha, or these different Buddha constructs, to stand side by side. Without any value necessary attachment. I choose one with which I am comfortable, but that doesn't mean I need to denigrate others.
Yeah. You have this line that I just really loved, was, according respect to all Buddhist traditions and to the uniqueness and value of their respective teachings, provide an indispensable foundation for the flowering of precisely the mental balance and attachment that should result from practicing in any of these traditions.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you're pointing at with that story, is that just in the capacity to be able to hold another person's idea of their Buddha, we're practicing skillful means, and we're practicing detachment, and we're practicing mental balance.
Yeah, we're practicing mindfulness, we're practicing equanimity, we're practicing compassion, it's all there.
Yeah. And I even wonder, even in the process of actually undertaking the work of understanding the context of particular concepts within a tradition, I'm wondering if there's even a practice when you notice a hindrance arise in your experience, it's an opportunity to practice with that, even in the process of comparison.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's always like this middle part, like we are not just mixing it all. And we are not also turning just a blind eye on shortcomings of particular Buddhist traditions, but we hold them at the same level.
Right.
We don't get into those type of mental states that we anyway want to get out. That's the practice, is about that, no?
Yeah.
About being mindful, equanimous, understanding. So it's not just pretending everything is the same and just turning a blind eye on things. But it has that spaciousness of mindfulness which allows me to position things. And some things, like that Buddha without the protuberance, is very close to me. And the Buddha with the protuberance is further away, but they can be in that same field. That same field of awareness.
There can be some sense sometimes in the West that that there's a goal of synthesis, and that there can be a sense that we can synthesize various lineages and various ideas to find something more complete and more full. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit to that that idea about synthesis. And is there something, I wondered if there's something called like a false synthesis, maybe that there's a way in which we can synthesize internally for ourselves, and kind of what we're talking about now, but then there's another way in which we can think that we can have a perfect answer or something unified in a certain sense. And wondering if you can speak a little bit to that.
Yeah, I think what you already said is pretty much what I also feel. Like, I mean, there is a personal synthesis that we find for ourselves. But to put this out as the one way to bring it all together, I'm quite skeptical about that. And this was already what I was trying to say before, this other extreme, the two-dimensional black and white, right and wrong, and the other one, put it in a mixer and mix it all together and you just get gray. And I think it is also, to some extent, a lack of respect towards the tradition. And as I have lived a long time in Asia, I do know that it is actually experienced as such, and that it is actually experienced as a continuity of the colonial arrogance, where the Westerners know it always so much better. And now they get Buddhism and they know it so much better. And now here in the West, we're going to build the real Buddhism. We're going to chuck out all these superstitions and all the other things, and this is going to be the real thing. And these fools over there, for the last 2,500 years, they just didn't understand it. I'm exaggerating a little bit to show the other extreme. And I think this is also not a wholesome state of mind. It's my personal feeling. My personal feeling is that we find our personal synthesis, but we allow the different traditions to be the way they are and respect them the way they come, with all their baggage of cultural, social, historical development, the way they come, instead of trying to amalgamate them into one thing, into the superior form of Buddhism that is now in the 21st century arising in the West. I think Western Buddhism again, I mean, I'm part of Western Buddhism, but Western Buddhism is just one form of Buddhism. And the claim to be the ultimate perfection of the different tradition, again, it has this, it has the roots for polemics, it has the roots for fundamentalism, it has the roots for denigration. It can lead to quite a lot of negativity. So I am personally more in favor of allowing the different traditions to stand where they are.
Have you practiced in other traditions, and have you had experiences in your past of this practice that we're talking about, of finding personal synthesis and personal understanding?
Well, I have been very much attracted to the Tibetan tradition, and I have been practicing Dzogchen with Tulku Ogyen at Nagi Gompa in Nepal. And I was a Theravada monk at that time. Still remember when he gives this instruction, they call that the pointing out instruction, and when he walked out, he was kind of looking at me. I was about 300 people, he was kind of looking, what is this fellow there? But this is what I also try to describe in the article about the Vipassana mindfulness and the Dzogchen mindfulness. So I found the type of mindfulness presented in the Dzogchen tradition eminently helpful. And particularly it lead me on towards emptiness practice. But there is part of that construct which affirms something that doesn't change. And this is something I did not find useful, because my whole practice is really based on this framework of the early suttas. And there it is fairly clear that there is nothing permanent. Even that which knows the consciousness or awareness, mindfulness, however you want it, it's a changing process. And so I did not want to give up that part, because I think it's essential for the path to liberation as taught in early Buddhism. But so within that place, I can place that Dzogchen practice and use it, but informed by the understanding that this type of rigpa is something that changes. And I found that worked very, very well, and according all the respect to the tradition, and not trying to pretend that the concepts that underlie Dzogchen are already found in early Buddhism, because that is the other problem of positing our historical reconstruction of Buddhism as the one right thing. When we take this kind of position, then everybody who finds anything useful from a later Buddhist tradition is kind of forced to pretend that this was already taught by the Buddha. And that as a major source of confusion and even at times of dishonesty. Obviously there is a continuity, and there are certain passages in the suttas that point in a certain direction, but certain ideas are obviously later, and we know that from the reconstruction, from the academic reconstruction of the history of Buddhist thought. And so to pretend that these were already taught by the Buddha is, and you can only do it by a process of what we call like cherry picking. You pick a few passages, ignore some others, and you construct your idea, and then you go, here, what I'm doing was already done by the Buddha. And I think this is not a very useful move.
Right. And for you, as somebody who has a great deal of respect for early Buddhism, there's a way in which you can respect others for acknowledging that their ideas may have come later, and letting that be okay, letting that be just as acceptable. They don't need to prove that it came from your ideas.
Exactly, that is my point. There is a tendency of saying early is good and late is bad, sort of. And that is just like, why? I mean, the Buddha didn't use airplanes, so should we stop using airplanes? And should we now construct some argument? Yeah, but you know, they had levitation at that time, and there is a rule, and then if there's no levitation, then I'm allowed to use an airplane, and this is rubbish, no? There's a little story again I like to tell. That's about when I was a kid, I was very interested into this evolution of species. So I would always go to the next museum in town, and we would go on excursion and search for fossils. And when I had my birthday, the other kids, they were getting all kind of toys, but I wanted the replica of an Archaeopteryx. The Archaeopteryx is the transition from reptile to bird. And I found that just so fascinating. You know, this idea, these small reptiles, they want to evade predatory animals, so they start climbing on trees. Now, to get from one tree to the other in a safe way, they start to jump from one branch of the other. And as they keep jumping, slowly, slowly, they start to develop like wings. And eventually, this is how birds came about. So this fascination of understanding a process is, in fact, what informs much of my academic work. I want to understand, how did it happen? But the thing is, this does not have to carry any value judgment. I don't have to say, reptiles are animals in their pristine purity. All these birds are later generations. This is foolish, no? I mean, birds are so beautiful. Can I allow the birds and the reptiles just be there without putting some value judgment, or to come back to our early thing, to pretend that the bird is a reptile so that it can go in here and then it comes from a reptile, but it is no longer a reptile. And I don't have to put reptiles up and birds down just because one is early and one is late. I can just allow them side by side.
Yeah, I love that idea of when you're interested in a tradition that you might not be familiar with, there can be this wonderful appreciation and beauty that comes out of seeing that thread for its own nature. And almost like there's, what I hear you saying is there's a way in which we can really step back from our own preconceptions and our own, that process of disentangling our own perceptions is its own, there's its own beauty there.
Yeah, beautifully said. That's exactly what I'm talking about. And there may be times that we get a little bit caught up because we all have still our ego, we identify with our tradition, but that is precisely where the mindfulness comes in. Where suddenly feel like, here I'm tightening down, here I'm becoming judgmental. And where we can come back to that spaciousness of not looking away, we are looking at it, we are knowing this is later, this is early, but not putting values on it. And not starting to, like, I'm good, those are bad, kind of. Because that is just not very skillful.
Yeah, I even wonder if there's an underlying fear that we have sometimes, and what is that fear of wanting to be right or something like that?
Yeah. You know. Exactly. Wanting to be right. And that's exactly where the mindfulness comes in. That is so important aspect of the mindfulness, this breadth of vision and this ability to live with what we call cognitive dissonance. Not thinking that because I am now doing like this, then everybody else should be doing the same. And if they do something different, in order to get them in my boat, I pretend that we are all the same anyway. Everybody's doing the same. This is just another way of strengthening the sense of that I'm right. But if we can let go of that and just allow things to stand as they are and find the right, our sense of assurance of rightness in holding that situation and being aware of it, that completely changes the situation. And we can allow these different flowers in the West of the different Buddhism to just grow and flourish in their own way. Allow them to stand side by side without having to put up and down, and not putting this discrimination, dogmatism, fundamentalism. I don't think we need that.
That's great.